From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, What Johnny Shouldn't Read, we talk with Joan Delfatour about textbook censorship. In her new book, she examines how both the right and the left try to influence the content of textbooks. Also, we meet a producer whose films you won't find in the movie theater. Charles Band makes direct-to-video, low-budget horror, sci-fi, and fantasy films like Puppet Master, Subspecies, and Demonic Toys. And Wild Thing rock historian Ed Ward looks back at the Trogs. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Bill Clinton campaigned in Connecticut today, where he outlined his plan to increase the number of manufacturing jobs. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Clinton addressed a group of workers at the employee-owned Standard Knap Company in Portland today. He laid out a plan he says will help reverse the loss of manufacturing jobs and the decline in manufacturing wages. Some of the proposals are ones Clinton has made before. He wants to create a civilian version of DARPA. That's the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency that sponsors research into new technology. And he wants a targeted investment tax credit to encourage businesses to invest in new plants here in the U.S. What was new was Clinton's proposal to set up 170 manufacturing extension centers. Similar to the Agricultural Extension Service, they would provide technical assistance to small manufacturing firms. Clinton said he'd spend $500 million a year on the centers. The money would come from the defense budget. In Connecticut, I'm Mara Liasson.
President Bush said today that he was waiving some federal rules to allow Virginia to test a new welfare program. The Virginia experiment would link school attendance to some welfare benefits in an effort to make education a higher priority to families on government assistance. The program will be tried in a limited number of schools where children in grades 6 through 8 must attend classes or their families will lose a portion of their welfare benefits. The Senate has set the stage for a showdown tomorrow on the controversial vote over President Bush's nomination of Alabama prosecutor Edward Carnes to a federal appeals court. NPR's Phyllis Crockett covered today's debate in the Senate.
Carnes' opponents argue that his nomination should be rejected because he is racially insensitive and unfair in prosecuting death penalty cases in which African Americans were routinely excluded from juries. Senator Edward Kennedy, a Carnes opponent, cites a study that found evidence indicating racial disparities in the imposition of the death penalty.
But Ed Carnes, who has spent virtually his entire professional career handling death penalty cases, believes that there's no discrimination in the application of the death penalty.
But supporters, led by Senator Hal Heflin, say Carnes' record has been distorted by those who see the nomination as a referendum on capital punishment. I'm Phyllis Crockett at the Capitol.
A former Exxon security officer pleaded guilty today to all federal charges in the kidnapping of Exxon executive Sidney Riso. In a hearing before a federal judge in New Jersey, Arthur Seal entered guilty pleas to 7 counts, including conspiracy, mail fraud, and extortion. Seal also faces state charges of kidnapping and murder. The 45-year-old former policeman said he didn't mean to kill Riso, who was abducted from the driveway of his home on April 29th. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials lost 21 points today to close at 3,261. This is NPR. African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela was in Siskai today, calling for the removal of the homeland's military ruler, whose troops killed 24 protesters yesterday and wounded 196. The ANC says the nominally independent homelands should revert to South Africa, but Siskai's ruler, General Opa Kuzo, has refused. ANC leaders have charged that South Africa's white minority government created the homelands to divide the country's black tribal groups and force them into what amounts to reservations. 2 weeks after Hurricane Andrew hit Homestead, Florida, people in the area are finally beginning to have their electric power turned back on. NPR's Derek Reveron reports.
It's only a few streets, but Homestead at last has electricity again, a Florida Power and Light spokesman announced today. Utility workers have rebuilt a power station in Homestead and started the tedious chore of replanting poles and stringing electrical lines. So far, power has been restored to only 2% of Homestead. Florida Power and Light spokesman Ray Golden says he doesn't know exactly when power will be fully restored. However, he says the process could take months. It could also be a long wait for residents of nearby Kendall, where 35% of power has been turned back on. Meanwhile, 89% of Dade County residents outside of Homestead and Kendall now have electrical power. In Miami, I'm Derek Reveron reporting.
Federal officials said today that the nation's flood insurance fund is solvent despite the costs of flood damage caused by Hurricane Andrew. The statement was a response to warnings from Senator John Kerry, who said well before hurricane season that a major coastal storm could bankrupt the flood insurance fund. The Massachusetts Democrat said that could leave taxpayers with a bill to rival the savings and loan fiasco. The Federal Insurance Administration said today that although Hurricane Andrew caused billions of dollars in damage because of high winds, flood damage was only about $150 million. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's back to school week, and we're going to talk about censorship in the schools. This month, the group People for the American Way issued a report on attempts to censor books and curricular materials in the nation's public schools. The report concludes that there was more censorship during the 1991-92 school year than any other year in the past decade. There was a 50% increase from the previous year in incidents of attempted censorship. Protesters succeeded in having the challenged materials removed or restricted 41% of the time. My guest Joan Delfatour is the author of a new book about textbook censorship in America called What Johnny Shouldn't Read. She's a professor of English at the University of Delaware. Delfatour examines how special interest groups influence what American children are taught in school. I asked her about the most frequently challenged subjects.
Depends on whether you're asking about challenges from the far left or the far right. The far left is easier to answer because they tend to be more focused. They will challenge junk food, believe it or not. They will challenge depictions of women and depictions of various racial and minority groups. The far right will challenge vegetarianism. They will challenge their versions, or they will want their versions of depictions of women and depictions of minority groups. So at that level, you've got a tug of war between the two groups. The far right goes on to get into areas that the far left does not. For example, the far right will challenge environmentalism and anything else they feel promotes world unity and goes against the interests of big business. They will challenge pacifism, tolerance for diversity, and anything that suggests gradual development that might lead to a belief in biological evolution.
There have been challenges lately against New Age beliefs in textbooks. When did New Age stuff started entering censorship challenges?
That's actually part of a continuing pattern. Earlier challenges in the 1980s tended to go under the banner of secular humanism, which was defined narrowly as a belief that human beings take the place of God. That is, a secular humanist is one who puts a human being into the place of God. That's part of the basis for the far right's objection to environmentalism, because to say that humans ought to take action to save the whales or not to pollute the planet takes over God's role, and therefore that is secular humanism. Well, gradually, as that term became worn out, and as it became so broadly defined that it came to represent everything that these people didn't believe in, these far-right groups began to switch to using the term New Age, but the topics are very much the same. If you eliminated secular humanism or New Age as words and simply looked at what people are protesting against, there hasn't been a change. There's only been a change in the banner under which they do these things.
Why is the word New Age used?
Well, the New Age does provide a kind of blanket definition of things that the far right objects to. It has a kind of sense of the occult. It has some sense of witchcraft, of otherworldliness that is not associated with God. It has a flavor of pantheism. I should also mention there is a slight change in focus. Under secular humanism, a lot of the focus was on evolution and on tolerance for diversity. Under New Age, usually protests will begin talking about the occult, as if that is the main issue, but then they'll get into those other issues as well.
Tell us the story of how you became involved with censorship issues in the schools.
I was teaching a summer course for high school teachers. It was a graduate course in literature, and we were studying Romeo and Juliet. Two of the teachers in the class were not using the paperback version. They were using the anthologies that they teach from in high school. Well, partway through the discussion, these two teachers raised their hands and they said, "We do not understand what you're talking about." So I thought about that because sometimes I don't understand what I'm talking about either. But in that case, what happened was that the anthologies were missing between 300 and 400 lines each.
So what sections were deleted of, was it Romeo and Juliet?
Yes. As you would expect, anything that suggested that Romeo and Juliet had a sexual relationship was deleted, which shortens the play considerably. And also things that had to do with religion. For example, there was a line by Romeo that says something about heretics being burned at the stake. And when I checked in other anthologies, that line is routinely removed. And I later found that the reason is because far-right groups object to associating religion with violence. So you can't refer to heretics being burned at the stake.
So did you find out who was behind having these lines deleted from Shakespeare?
Well, what I found was not the specific answer to that, but rather a movement in this country, both in the far right and the far left, to influence the content of textbooks by using both the textbook adoption process in large states and the federal court system.
Let's look at textbook challenges in the court system and how effective they've been. One of the exemplary cases that you look at in your book, What Johnny Shouldn't Read, is a case that took place in 1983 in Hawkins County, Tennessee. What was the offending material that was being challenged?
The series that was challenged is put out by Holt Reinhart Winston. It was called the Basic Reading Series. It was the 1983 edition of it. What happened there was that a rural school district in Hawkins County, Tennessee, had been using very traditional readers, the kind that older people would remember as similar to the Dick and Jane ones. Everybody lives in the suburbs, everybody's white, everybody's middle class, everybody goes to church on Sunday. There's no there's no multicultural element, there's no discussion of things like environmentalism and so on. And that's what the books in Hawkins County had been like. Well, in 1983, the Hawkins County School Board adopted the Holt Reinhart Winston Basic Reading Series, which has minority groups, it has people living in cities, it has some children who live with only one parent. It has the majority of stories are very traditional. People would recognize them as very similar to what would have been in earlier books. But there was this mixture. And a group of far-right parents in Hawkins County, Tennessee, objected very strongly to those books.
And what was the judge's ruling?
The judge's ruling in that case was, at the district court level, was in favor of the protesters. He said that they had sincere religious beliefs, and although those religious beliefs were very far from the mainstream of American culture, they had a right to those beliefs. And so he ruled that the school district had to allow those children to remain in the public schools, but excuse them from reading class, so they would be homeschooled only for reading. He also ruled that the school district had to pay the parents a total of over $50,000 to reimburse them for the cost of sending their children to private schools while the case was being litigated. That ruling was overturned on appeal. The federal appeals court ruled that all that happened in those books was that children were exposed to ideas that their parents disagreed with. And he said there is nothing in the First Amendment that guarantees that you will never hear ideas you disagree with. So you might say that the protesters lost.
Okay, so the protesters finally lost that. But you say you might say the protesters lost.
Right.
Because why are you saying they might have lost when, in fact, they lost?
They lost legally. They lost the case. If they send their children to the Hawkins County schools, they have to use the books that are in those schools. But in a larger sense, they didn't lose. The New York Times carried a full-page, two-column comparison between the 1983 edition of the Holt Reinhart Winston Basic Reading Series and the 1986 edition. And that comparison showed many changes made in the 1986 edition that were in keeping with what the protesters in that court case had wanted. The lawyers in that court case, which was still going on, the case ran from 1983 to 1987. So when the 86 Holt Reinhart Winston series came out, the case was still being litigated. The lawyers got an expert witness from Texas. His name is Mel Gabler. He's been active in the Texas textbook adoption process for many years. He would be on the same side as the protesters in Hawkins County. He would be in favor of traditional values and opposed to the new ideas in the textbooks. He testified that he had read all of the reading books that were proposed for use in Texas in 1986, not just the Holt Reinhardt Winston, and that he was very pleased with all of them, that they were all much better, from his perspective, than the books had been in 1980. So it's hard to say that those protesters were on the losing side of the case if the books that were sold throughout the country reflected more their view than they had before.
So you think that there's a degree of self-censorship and economic pressure that results when textbooks are challenged, even if the challengers lose?
Yes. Actually, you can prove that in a couple of ways. For one thing, the textbook adoption process in Texas and California is very influential in determining what goes into the textbooks that are sold throughout the country. Publishers will try very hard to produce books that will sell in Texas and California. Those two states between them represent roughly 20%, one out of five textbook sales in the country. So it makes sense for the publishers to try to sell the books there. Well, because the publishers know that they have to get through the approval process in Texas and California, where textbooks are approved on a statewide level, not district by district, the publishers will try to anticipate problems that they might come up against. They will also make changes in the textbooks based on what Texas or California asked them to do. Because of the buying power in Texas and California, publishers will submit pre-publication copies to those two states. That is, they will let people in the state see the book at a point where the book could still be changed. The state of Texas every year puts out a document called Corrections and Changes Requested of Textbook Publishers, and they list all of the things that the publishers must change in the book as a condition of having it accepted in Texas. California is a little less direct. They have what they call social content standards that have to do with the depiction of minorities and women and with junk food. And if a book is out of conformity, they will ask the publisher to come up with a variation that they can use.
Certainly, if you're a textbook publisher, you'd like to have your books bought by these states. Mm-hmm. That's going to really help a lot with your sales. And if these states don't buy them, that's going to hurt you. Mm-hmm. What are some of the restrictions in the Texas guidelines? Are there restrictions?
Yes. There are restrictions in the Texas guidelines that essentially say the books should be patriotic, they should support authority. There is nothing in the Texas guidelines that explicitly talks about not having a variety or not having diversity. But the protesters in Texas, regardless of what the guidelines say, the protesters in Texas are very influential. Let me give you one example. There is a Texas guideline that says that books are supposed to show the free enterprise system in a positive light. Well, Mel and Norma Gabler, who are the leading protesters in Texas, argued that the New Deal could not be presented as an important event in American history or as having had any influence in relieving the Depression, because that would go against the free enterprise system. And the way they reasoned was the New Deal involved income taxes, it involved restrictions on big business, and therefore the Gablers saw the New Deal as anti-free enterprise. So they objected to the New Deal being presented in a favorable light, and they induced the Texas Board of Education to rewrite the paragraph describing the New Deal and to tell the publisher that unless they put the paragraph that the Texas Board of Ed had written rather than the original paragraph in the book would not be sold in Texas. The Gablers also objected to including the New Deal on a timeline of important events in American history. The publisher went along with what the Texas Board of Ed asked them to do. They removed their original paragraph and replaced it with the paragraph that had been written in Texas. And if you unfold that timeline, you'll find a gap between Hoover and Pearl Harbor where they whited out the New Deal, because otherwise they could not have sold the book in Texas. I was in Texas doing research, and I found in the records that this book had been changed by replacing the original paragraph with a paragraph Texas Board of Ed had written, and also taking the New Deal off the timeline. So when I got back to Delaware, I found a school that uses that book and went out and got a copy of it. And sure enough, when I opened it to that page, the paragraph that was in that book that was being used in Delaware was the paragraph that had been written by the Texas Board of Education, with, of course, no indication that that's how that interpretation of the New Deal got into the book. And when I unfolded the timeline, I found a gap between Hoover and Pearl Harbor where the New Deal had been whited out.
So a very conservative state's restrictions will affect the rest of the country.
And that is also true of a liberal state's preferences. The publishers will try to produce books that will sell in both Texas and California, and so they will make compromises between what the protesters in each state would want. I should say at this point, the protesters in Texas and California do not represent the whole state. People in Texas are embarrassed by the more extreme right protesters. This is not what Texas wants. This is a particular political group. And the same thing is true on the far left. There are many people who consider themselves liberals who are embarrassed by the extremist liberals who want textbook censorship.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Joan Delfatore. She's the author of the new book, What Johnny Shouldn't Read, Textbook Censorship in America. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Joan Delfatore is my guest, the author of a new book about textbook censorship in America. I don't understand how publishers are dealing with these contradictory pressures on them. You know, on the one hand, from conservative states, the pressures to have women in traditional roles. Mm. From states that are more liberal, to have women in depicted as working people and as mothers. You know, and that's just one example. So, are some publishers dealing with some pressures and not others? Or are you finding this kind of bizarre mix of cultural points of view in the textbooks?
A bizarre mix is a good way of putting it. What happens is that no matter how intense the protesters are, they recognize they're not going to get everything they want. What they're trying to do is influence the books as far as they can. So the publishers will try to give a little to each side. Let me give you an example. The liberal side will say, let's have more material by African Americans. The conservative side will say, that's not important. It takes the place of things that are important. The far right side is also very uncomfortable with any depiction of anything that puts the United States in a negative light. So to talk about civil rights and then to talk about Jim Crow laws and all of the kinds of injustices that sparked the civil rights movement, to them is promoting communism by making people disrespectful of the United States. That's the basis on which these people will try to eliminate all African-American writers from literature anthologies on the grounds that all of them were communist, because these folks identify a communist as anyone who doesn't like the social or economic setup of this country the way it is, which does tend to eliminate most African-American writers. Well, publishers will put in African-American writers because they know that they cannot sell the books in the more liberal markets if they do not do that. But they will edit what they put in so that it does not contain the themes that are offensive to the far right. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, for instance, is in the public domain. The publishers will eliminate specific references to particular states and to particular acts of racism, with the result that if you read down the table of contents, Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech is there. But if you actually compare it with the original, it comes out sounding like a valediction address, a high school valedictorian address, because all of the anger has been taken out of it. I went down to Texas to listen to the textbook, to the public hearings for the textbook selection process. And they were adopting literature textbooks, and the far-right protesters got up and objected to every African-American writer in every literature textbook on the grounds that they were all communists. But the protesters kept saying, we're not racist. It's only because they're communists. That's why we object to them. When the publishers would point out that even if a particular African-American writer such as Langston Hughes was indeed a communist, the particular poetry that they had selected of Hughes's was absolutely innocuous. It did not carry any of that flavor. The protesters would say that's worse because you are deceiving the children into admiring Hughes without telling them the truth that he was a communist. Well, one protester, when she finished this argument, was about to leave the microphone, and then she came back and she referred to a full-page picture of Langston Hughes, and she said, and besides that, the children in Texas don't need to see that big black face looking out at them out of their textbook.
Wow.
And yet there's still the insistence this is not racism.
Did you go to any hearings in California?
Yes, I did.
What did you see there?
Interestingly, the hearings in California were dominated by far-right protesters, but I think the reason that happened is because the establishment in California, that is the institutionalized textbook selection process, already has embodied in it the viewpoints of the left group. For example, there is a law in the state of California, and it is a law, not an education regulation, that foods of low nutritive value may not be promoted through elementary and secondary school textbooks. So even though the education authorities say that all that was meant to do was prevent publishers from constantly saying things like 2 lollipops plus 3 lollipops and 4 cookies plus 5 cookies, in fact, the way it's interpreted causes publishers to change even classic literature to take out references to pies and cakes and hamburgers and that type of thing. The same thing happens with depictions of minority groups and women. The California social content guidelines require a variety of racial and ethnic groups, a variety of roles for women. That in itself, particular people may consider that's good or bad. But as far as the protesters are concerned, those values are already part of the California system. So it's primarily the far right that protests at the public hearings because they are the ones whose views are not being represented in the institutionalized rules.
What do you see when you look ahead into the 90s? What kind of issues do you think will come up that might be different than the ones that did in the 80s?
In the 1980s, far-right textbook protests tended to be under the heading of secular humanism. As the 1990s progressed, more and more protests are under the heading of New Age. The protest will say, this book teaches New Age philosophy. Those protests tend to lead off with complaints about witchcraft and the occult, which had always been part of the picture. The Wizard of Oz has been one of the most challenged books in the country for years, on the grounds that it not only has the occult in it, but the challenge is that it promotes Satan worship, because Glenda the Good Witch is looked up to as a good figure. So if, in fact, she's...
Hey, it's all a dream.
That's right. Well, that's worse. The other complaint is that it makes real life in Kansas look dull because that's shown in black and white in the movie, and the fantasy world is shown in color, and that shows that fantasy is being preferred to reality, and it's encouraging children to take drugs. I'm not being funny. That's what the protesters will say.
Obviously, you consider textbook censorship a really major problem. Do you think there are any solutions?
I think the point we're at right now is trying to define the problem and trying to figure out how to solve it in a way that respects the religious rights of the individuals who are protesting on the far right, that respects the views of the people protesting from the far left, and at the same time does not allow those extremist views to dominate education to the extent that they do. I don't think that the solution, when we finally find one, is going to come out of any one institution. I don't think it's something education can solve alone. It already involves the federal courts. It already involves state legislation. It already involves constitutional issues. I think that what we have here is a problem in education that reflects a problem in the whole culture. This culture is becoming more and more pluralistic. People who were a very small minority 50 years ago are large enough now to be making themselves heard. People who 100 years ago would put up with or accept the idea that they were not going to be represented in textbooks now want to be represented. So the culture is changing. It's almost like in physics, the Big Bang sort of theory of an expanding universe. And I think what's happening in education is just one of many things happening in our culture where that increasing pluralism is causing unrest. I don't think you're going to solve the education problem, the textbook selection problem, without addressing the larger problem.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
Joan Delfatour is the author of What Johnny Shouldn't Read, Textbook Censorship in America. It's published by Yale University Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Puppet Master, Leech Woman, Demonic Toys, and Subspecies. We'll talk with Charles Band about producing cheapo, quickie, fantasy, sci-fi, and horror films. He doesn't even try to get them booked in theaters. His films go straight to video, and he says there's no shame in that. In fact, it may be the wave of the future. Also, rock historian Ed Ward remembers the Troggs, who had the hit Wild Thing. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In South Africa, supporters of the African National Congress have ended their vigil at the border of Ciskei, halting for now at least a tent standoff after government troops opened fire this week, killing 24 people. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Bishu.
Thousands of ANC supporters marched to Ciskei yesterday, saying they planned to occupy Bishu until its military ruler stepped down. Ciskei is one of 10 black homelands created by the apartheid system as quasi-autonomous regions, though ANC leaders say they are no more than surrogates of the South African government. Ciskei troops shot with no warning yesterday, shortly after the marchers crossed into the homeland. This morning, a parade of anti-apartheid leaders, including ANC President Nelson Mandela, visited the site of the shootings to express their outrage. Protesters who kept vigil at the border last night finally left their encampment with Mandela. But Mandela renewed his demand that Ciskei strongman Upa Khosa step down, and other ANC officials warned that the fight over Ciskei has not ended. I'm Ann Cooper in Bishu.
In a bid for Jewish votes in this fall's election, President Bush went before a meeting in Washington today of B'nai B'rith to talk about his administration's efforts to help the state of Israel. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Helping Jews from the former Soviet Union and Ethiopia emigrate to Israel, prodding the UN to repeal the resolution equating Zionism with racism, defeating Saddam Hussein's forces, sponsoring Middle East peace talks, and now asking Congress for up to $10 billion in loan guarantees for Israel. These are the ways the Bush administration is helping the Jewish state, Mr. Bush argued. And on the Israeli-Palestinian peace talks, the president reiterated a position that the Israeli government once emphasized.
Yes, I still oppose a Palestinian state. I've been consistent on that for a long, long time.
But the president spent little time in his remarks addressing the domestic political concerns of the Jewish American community, the economy, separation of church and state, and race relations, for example. Many analysts say these are now the key campaign issues among Jewish Americans. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Presidential candidate Bill Clinton has been campaigning in the Northeast today, where in the state of Connecticut he promised to spend some $2 billion a year to help the nation's manufacturing sector create more jobs. Clinton charged that the Bush administration stood by as 1.3 million manufacturing jobs were lost over the past 4 years. Clinton also called for creation of some 170 manufacturing extension centers around the nation. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 21 points in moderate trading. This is NPR News. Serbian officials in Bosnia say their forces will turn over heavy guns around the capital to UN supervisors over the next 2 days. If this does take place, it would be in advance of a Saturday deadline set by UN officials. At the same time, the airport at Sarajevo is still closed, and people are combing streets and hillsides for food and wood. A UN airlift was suspended last week after an Italian cargo plane carrying food and medicine was shot down, apparently by a missile. A strike by more than 10,000 public school teachers in Detroit entered its second week today after court-ordered bargaining throughout the Labor Day weekend failed to narrow the gap between the two sides. Don Gagne reports.
No talks are scheduled for today in Detroit, though a state mediator has been called in to review the bargaining positions of both sides. So it's another day of summer vacation for the district's 168,000 students. The Detroit Federation of Teachers is asking for a pay raise of 6% for the coming school year, but officials in the financially strapped school district say there's no way they can afford that. They are offering instead a one-time bonus worth 3% of a teacher's annual pay. Another contentious issue that has arisen is that of empowerment, a program by which school principals, parents, and teachers are given more power in running the schools. The teachers' union is hesitant to sign on to such a plan, citing the potential for abuse. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
Italian officials have announced plans for sending more aid to Somalia, while at the same time making a new effort to start peace talks there between rival factions. Some Italian companies have been accused of dumping waste off the coast of Somalia, and the prime minister, who has been on a visit to that country, said that he would look into the matter. Residents of the war-torn and starving nation have criticized Italy for its slow response. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Charles Band is one of Hollywood's most prolific producers of science fiction and fantasy films. He's made about 85 movies in 20 years. But you've probably never heard of most of his films, and you definitely didn't see any of the recent ones in movie theaters. He makes movies that are quick and cheap and go direct to video. Puppet Master, Dr. Mordred, and Trancers are some of his titles. They're distributed by his company, Full Moon Entertainment. Before his direct-to-video days, he did produce movies for theaters, some of which you probably have heard of, like Reanimator and Ghoulies. What he's doing now just may be the marketing wave of the future. As for the content, Puppet Master is about an ex-Nazi who brings his murderous puppets to life. Leech Woman spits leeches onto her victims. Trancers is about a cop named Jack Death who time travels to prevent zombies from taking over the world.
With a couple of exceptions, all the films that I've produced or made or directed at Full Moon have been my own creation, so to speak. I come up with the basic idea, the title, the campaign. Those elements usually come first. And then depending on what picture it is, I'll either develop an actual story outline and then, cause the picture to get made and find the right writers and director. Or I'll actually, just come up with the premise, the basic, thumbnail sketch of the story, and then different writers will, be involved in that phase. The original idea is really not much more than that. The premise of Bad Channels I came up with along with the title, there's a difference between that and taking a story by credit, which I do sometimes when I actually write out, the three acts and I really give the writer a blueprint of what the thing should be all about. But the most fun I have with this whole enterprise is coming up with all these crazy ideas and characters and creatures and critters.
So what's the crazy idea behind Bad Channels?
Bad Channels, I think we went too far with the crazy idea because it actually fits a little or falls a little out of the Full Moon norm. But in a nutshell, strange space alien comes to Earth who's a collector, and he takes over a radio station. And through that station, he is able to monitor with some of his space-age paraphernalia and gadgetry. He's able to monitor everyone visually who's listening to that particular set of songs. And, of course, he zeroes in on attractive young ladies, and we soon learn as different events unfold, because he takes over the radio station and kind of hijacks the whole place, that he's a collector of earthlings, and specifically earthwomen, earthbabes. So he zaps them through, the ones that he likes, and they wind up coming into this stuff that he's brought, and they wind up being reduced to 12 inches, and they're in these glass jars. And of course, the story's about our DJ and a friend of his who wind up, trying to save the day. And in fact, at the end of the picture, his mission is kind of aborted, and he has to go back. And all the Earth chicks who were trapped into these jars regain their normal size, except one. There's actually one left at the end of the movie, who is forever trapped in this 12-inch little body. And, of course, that was by design because we made a picture about half a year before that did very well for us called Doll Man, which is our copy line is 13 inches with an attitude. And I think one of the reasons why Doll Man was so bummed out is he had no women. So now we have Doll Chick. We have a little girl for Doll Man.
This reminds me of a movie I saw with, great British actor, forgetting his name.
Okay.
And he finds this ray, I think, to reduce people to a few inches high. Do you know the movie?
Oh, sure. The name escapes me as well, but wonderful.
Anyways, yes.
And all part of the inspiration for all this stuff.
So did you grow up watching a lot of
watching it, and also I still am a big comic book fanatic. I was, you know, I was in love with all the early Marvel comics of the early 60s, and I truly feel what Full Moon really is the comic books of the 90s. You know, we're making, to a degree, it's a throwback to the serials of the 30s and 40s, but at least with the pictures that we've made that have premiered directly on home video, they're all designed to be sequelable and seriesable, and those that really work, in fact, do go to series. We have, you know, our Puppet Master series, our Trancer series, our Subspecies series. And a lot of what we're doing is exactly what the comics did in the early 60s. So we're beginning to cross over characters and team people up. And in fact, apropos Bad Channel's Doll Chick and Doll Man, we just completed a movie that'll be out early next year, which is called Doll Man versus the Demonic Toys. So Doll Man teams up with Doll Chick and they fight the Demonic Toys, which is another little franchise that we began.
My guest is Charles Band, the head of Full Moon Entertainment, which produces science fiction and fantasy films. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest Charles Band makes low-budget sci-fi and fantasy films. Now, you got into movies really as a boy. When you were 9 years old, you moved to Italy, where your father was making, what, spaghetti westerns? Mm-hmm. So he got his start in America?
Yes, my dad worked with John Huston for years. They did. My dad was assistant director on Red Badger Courage and Asphalt Jungle and made films here in the 50s when I was a real little kid. And then he made two horror films himself that both did quite well. He made a film called I Bury the Living with Richard Boone that plays a lot, and another picture called Face of Fire with Richard Widmark. But he was being pulled into television, which was what was happening here in the 50s, and he was not into that at all. So he decided that it was time for the family to move to Europe, at least for a year. There seemed to be a lot of action in Italy, you know, Hollywood on the Tiber. And he promised the family we'd be back in a year. You know, as a nine-year-old kid, that's the last thing you want to do is to move to Europe. You don't even know what Europe is, let alone having to leave your friends. And we stayed 11 years. That 1 year turned into 11 years. So I was there from age 9 to age 20, and I don't regret a minute of it.
So what kind of movies did your father make in Italy?
He made a lot of spaghetti westerns and epics. He made everything from The Avenger, starring Steve Reeves, to...
Steve Reeves, oh boy.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I played Steve Reeves' son in that movie when
I was a little kid.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Little guy with curly hair, and that was me.
And Steve Reeves was Hercules in the films.
Oh, yeah. This film was made... I mean, he was very popular at the time, so I guess it was his second or third film after the two Hercules films. Then he made a bunch of spaghetti westerns, pictures like A Minute to Pray, A Second to Die, working with actors like Robert Ryan and Joseph Cotten. And so it was a great place to be, to grow up. We didn't shoot them all in Italy. He shot some in Spain, some in Yugoslavia, you know, back then what was Yugoslavia. And so it was wonderful. And I loved the business from the very beginning, and I really grew up on a movie set. So he put me to work. He said, look, if you're into this, then you should really learn, you know, how it all works. So I really did a little bit of everything as a kid. I mean, you know, including a lot of real grungy jobs that, you know.
Like what?
I mean, I think the worst job I ever had, and this was during a summer break, is back then, and it's a technical thing, but today there's a machine that numbers your negative. You shoot film and you get your negative developed and you make your prints. And this machine, every 2 feet, puts a number on the negative so that the negative editor can identify when to cut and blah, blah, blah. Well, back then there was no such machine. So you sat there with a fountain pen and white ink, and you had to hand number those numbers. And it's something, I mean, if you think about it, an average film shoots 200,000 to 300,000 feet of film. I mean, I numbered one movie for a whole summer. It was terrible. But, you know, you're in that environment, you understand the editing process, and it just makes you appreciate the whole process of filmmaking, not just the kind of the glory stuff, like, you know, being a director, which is, you know, kind of the captain of the ship, but you... it's good to know how it all works. So I went to like the ultimate film school of all time. I grew up in this, and he made me do everything, which I really appreciate now.
Now, what was your movie education like outside of making your father's movies with him? Growing up in Italy, did you get to see a lot of American films, and did you get to see them in English?
No, I actually have seen most of the great films you see as a kid in Italian, so that was an interesting sort of... And then years later, I would see them again in English. I would say it was a combination, a diet of some wonderful films that were made in the 60s, especially European and Italian films, like Fellini films and Pasolini films and Antonioni films. And that plus the great music of the 60s and comic books.
I find it interesting that, someone like yourself who makes what, would be considered by a lot of people just like schlocky, cheap films, right? You just grew up in movies. You've always been interested in movies.
Right.
You've always been serious to some degree or another about movies.
Mm-hmm.
So how come you didn't aspire to make small art films or really, personal independent films? Instead, you're doing like teen genre films.
Well, again, if you look at the body of work, you'll find that the large majority of the films, even though they are genre films, they are all pretty credible films. Some of them do have, they're certainly little morality plays. They've never been hard, violent movies. I've never made a slasher film. I think you'll find that in many of the pictures, women have real strong roles. They usually save the day at the end of the film. And I love these movies. I mean, I enjoy making these films, and I never felt like wanting to do anything else. I'd like to see Full Moon again become bigger and better and be involved in all sorts of entertainment, which is going to be fascinating in the future. But I enjoy making these pictures. And someone asked me a few days ago at one of these retailer things, why don't you make maybe some erotic thrillers? And, to me, that's like a fate worse than death. I prefer to go out and sell real estate than have to make yet another version of Fatal Attraction. It's like you can't avoid these movies now. They're like, and then now the big studios are making them with big budgets and famous stars. So I have no taste for that. And that's not to say that there isn't life between fantasy and erotic thrillers, but I do enjoy our genre.
You obviously know a lot about marketing movies, so I want to talk with you a little bit about how that works, because I think the marketing of movies has changed a lot in the past decade or two. And let's see what insights you can share with us about that. First of all, your movies tend to go direct to cassette,
mm-hmm.
Direct to video. And I always think of that as a sign of failure,
mm-hmm.
right? Like
mm-hmm.
the movie, the distributors had so little faith in the movie and they were so unable to interest theaters in it, mm-hmm. that it ended up going direct to video. But you make movies to go direct to
mm-hmm.
video.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you intentionally do that?
Well, the truth is today, first of all, the home video business is the largest slice of the revenue pie, number one. It's really no longer the tail that's, wagging the dog here. We're looking at a business that's bigger than the theatrical business. And the theatrical business over the last few years has really changed radically. It's a very unforgiving marketplace. You have a situation today where genre films especially are being made with colossal budgets. Jurassic Park is approaching $100 million. Terminator 2 is $80 million. And these are all films in the genre that I'm making films in and have been for 20 years. So when the theatrical marketplace releases those sort of mega-budget movies and they spend $15 to $30 million over a weekend promoting them, the margin of error is pretty phenomenal for a small movie that wants to go out there and compete. It's impossible to compete in that sort of marketplace. And it's certainly not wise as an investment to go out there and risk bet the whole company on the release of one movie, which is what invariably happens when you're a small company, because the majors have history and banking and big balance sheets to absorb the few losses or the more than few losses they have during the course of a year. But a little company can go out of business if it does that. So as a combination of the theatrical marketplace becoming real tricky, and I think a marketplace now reserved for event movies.
So here's a problem I see. I think most people, when they go to the home video store, rent something that they wanted to see last year, earlier this year, a couple of years ago, and they missed,
mm-hmm.
or something from the past that they want to see again
mm-hmm.
or that
mm-hmm.
they missed.
Mm-hmm.
But it's usually going to be something they've heard of.
Mm-hmm.
If something goes directly to video, you never heard of it. It wasn't advertised on TV because it was never in the theaters. Your
mm-hmm.
friends didn't go to see it because there was no place for them to see it. So how do you let people know a movie exists when it's going to direct-to-video?
That's a good point. Well, the philosophy behind Full Moon, and again, I've done this now for about 20 years, and I'd say for the first 16 years, I made 8 billion different mistakes. You do that, and you learn how to survive in this business. And the pictures I made have always universally made money. I've made a lot of good, you know, well-received commercial films. But as far as how to really put it all together under one roof, one umbrella, and do something building towards the future, it took a lot of years to, you know, kind of get to where we are now with Full Moon. And the idea from the beginning was, and I say this with a certain amount of humility, I mean, it's tough to make the statement, but I would think that the end goal for Full Moon is to be to fantasy what Disney is to a family entertainment. I mean, that's where I would like Full Moon to be. And the whole idea was to create a brand label awareness, something that the public, both the video retailers who have to stock in the first place and the public who need to discover the films, would begin to trust and build a loyalty towards the label, not the specific films. That was the design from the beginning.
But who shops for videos that way?
To give you an idea, and you could talk, you know, at random to a number of video stores, there are about 30,000 video retailers in this country, and we have something called the Full Moon Video Retailer Fan Club, and we have about 15,000 members, 15,000 retailers in that fan club. So about half of all the video retailers in this country are members of that fan club. Many of them have a Full Moon section, and they now, over the last year or so, since we've proven ourselves to be kind of unique in the business, they are no longer buying a specific title. They're just buying the next Full Moon film.
Charles Band is the head of Full Moon Entertainment. This is Fresh Air. Lynn Neary is with us. Lynn, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, NPR's Ann Cooper will be reporting from South Africa that today African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela has called for the removal of the leader of the Black Homeland, where yesterday an estimated 24 people were killed when soldiers opened fire on a demonstration. NPR's David Malpas is in Dade County, Florida, where elections are being held today. However, David Malpas will be reporting that most residents of Dade County and South Florida are not taking advantage of the elections. They have much too much on their minds, still cleaning up after Hurricane Andrew. And we'll have a conversation with Laird Robinson, who helped Norman McLean research his book, Young Men and Fire.
Thanks, Lynn. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The group The Troggs is celebrating its 26th anniversary in the rock and roll business this year. Rock historian Ed Ward says probably no career has produced so much dumb fun as these guys.
It is unquestionably one of the greatest rock and roll records ever. Great because, well, because it's so bad. Not the song, Wild Thing. As Jimi Hendrix proved not long after it was released, the song was capable of a lot of, shall we say, interpretation. But the Troggs, the band that found the song in a pile of demo recordings by an obscure country and western songwriter who was also John Voight's brother, the Troggs were bad enough to make it good. But who were the Troggs, anyway? They were Reg Presley, born Reginald Maurice Ball, a bricklayer from Andover, Hampshire, his co-worker, drummer Ronnie Bond, bassist Pete Staples, and guitarist Chris Britton. Reg and Ronnie had had a band that broke up, leaving Ronnie with a drum kit to pay off. Somehow, they got into the good graces of Larry Page, the Kinks manager, who got them a deal in early 1966 with CBS Records.
Bless my girl, I can't express my grief, my sorrow, my emptiness. I hope someday that she'll hear my plea, and with open arms she will run to me. Yes, she will.
Their first record, Lost Girl, understandably sank without trace, and CBS dropped them. Unfazed, Larry Page got them a deal with Fontana. They found Wild Thing and recorded it, and the Troggs, the name was short for troglodytes, British hippies who were living in caves, were at the top of the American and British charts. The follow-up was just as primitive and catchy.
I want to spend my life with a girl like you. Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba, ba-ba-ba-ba, and do all
But since it didn't do too well over here, and because you could get away with things like that in those days, they pretty much copied it exactly and tried again.
Oh, no! I can't stand still 'cause you've got me going. Your slacks are low and your hips are showing. Your long black hair. Don't want you going round with no one else. 'Cause when I'm with you, I can't control myself.
That line about your slacks are low and your hips are showing cost them British airplay when the BBC banned I Can't Control Myself, and the Trogs seemed to disappear. But actually, they didn't. They were on the Page One label, and if you think that was owned by their manager, Larry Page, you're right. So, as the Beatles recorded Revolver and the smell of incense filled the air, the Trogs were doing stuff like this.
Give it to me, give it to me. All your love, give it to me.
Gotta hand it to Page and to Reg Presley and the guys. They didn't give up, and at the end of 1967, they actually cracked the top 10, or the top 100 for that matter, for the last time.
I feel it in my fingers. I feel it in my toes. Love is all around me, and so the feeling.
You heard those chords before? The Trogs continued to release records through 1976, and for years, an underground tape filled with profanity, drunken behavior, and awful playing made the rounds, proof that the Trogs were a bunch of incompetent goofballs, as far as most people were concerned. They still had hits in places like South Africa and Spain, but earlier this year, when I was visiting friends in Holland and noticed that a Trogs tour there had just been canceled, I was amazed they were still around. Not just around. I returned home to find that a new Trogs record, Athens Andover, had just come out, with help from REM's guitarist, Peter Buck. So watch out, folks. The Trogs aren't through with you yet.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a new novel about incest from a writer who says she hates the whole literature of victimology and considers many books on incest pseudo-porn. We'll find out why, in spite of her misgivings, Dorothy Allison wrote a novel based on how she was abused. In the New York Times, the novel was described as simply stunning. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.